Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the world's first and largest global fintech podcast. The Money 2020 edition, coming to you from Las Vegas, thanks to NTT Data. This is JP Nichols. I'm here with Jason Henricks, along with Brett King was here this week. Ron Shevlin was here. We had a whole lot of interviews, a whole lot of shows. We are going to have a jam-packed show today, and I think it's going to carry over to next week. We have so many interviews. Jason, what is your head still spinning from
2020? Head is still spinning. Voice is still cracking. I feel, you know, like I'm a roulette machine right now of ideas spinning around. It's exciting to compare, you know, back to thinking of the very first Money 2020. What's exciting is not just the growth they've had, but who's here and what they're doing. Of course, they're the financial service players. Those were the ones, you know, thinking back to that first Money 20, we were all here. And it's not just the technology providers, but right. Who are those technology providers? When we say fintech, we often mean, oh, the startups. But we're seeing really exciting things coming out of mainstream technology providers. The cores are doing interesting things. Adjacent players are doing interesting things. And a continued, you know, growth in the adjacent players. Huge presence from a lot of the retailers talking about frictionless commerce. And they all had just a host of exciting announcements and things to share.
Well, they do. And we're going to make some of them on the show today. So we should probably get to it.
So I'm here with Jamie Campbell, head of awareness for Bud.
Hey, how's it going?
I am aware of you, so I guess you've done your job.
Yeah, job done. Take it. Go home now.
So you're wearing, of course, a very fashionable hipster beard today.
And the hipster glasses.
And the hipster glasses. You have to get the visual right for given we're on radio. But you guys have a special announcement, so let's get straight to it. What's happening with Bud?
Yeah, so the announcement is we've just secured some funding from two very well-known banks, Investec and Sabadell, who acquired TSB in the UK in 2015. Just closed around 1.5 million to get things kicking off in the UK and Europe, bringing marketplace banking into the mainstream.
Now, would you say this is a bit of a pivot to you to working with banks, or because Bud originally you started off independent of the banks? Is that a right way to classify it?
Yeah, I think when we looked at the going direct to customers. The time it would take to acquire the customers to really train the best part of the technology, which is the machine learning algorithms and the neural network that kind of sits behind all the clever recommendations that the product does, the time it takes to go and get those customers, it just made so much more sense to work with the banks to deliver a solution where customers already were, where they were doing their banking in a way that doesn't mean that they have to change their habits. So this just comes as an update to an app, or you can refresh a web page and suddenly, you get all these new capabilities plugged straight into the banking experience. So, that's the kind of dream that we wanted to achieve.
So you get scale, you get revenue, you get data to feed your engine, and you do that in such a way where you provide a service to banks which allows them to bend space and time. They can do it faster and cheaper than if they did it themselves.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think, one of the things that that Bud does, which is huge value to banks, is it allows them to understand the journeys that their customers are on. So whether it's you're buying a house or whether it's saving up for a holiday, there's more than just one product that sits on that journey. Traditionally banks would think of that journey as oh, they need a mortgage, but there's the budgeting that happens up front, right. Budgeting with a partner as well. There's the kind of credit score and kind of optimizing that so that you are attractive as a customer. Then the mortgage, that's when the mortgage comes in. And then post moving into your new, brand new home, you've got, insurance, home insurance and utilities. So understanding that journey that the customers are on and supplying products, third party products from new providers all along that journey means that banks can offer much more value to their customers. And the flexibility of using these third parties mean that the customers are going to be really well served along that entire experience.
Yeah, it's interesting because banks they don't seem to comprehend as yet the fact that home buying experience is changing pretty significantly. That if I, what I trust from a bank is your ability to help me buy a home, not provide a mortgage.
Yeah.
And there's a big gap right now between being able to help you buy a home and providing you with a mortgage. And that's where the opportunity lies.
I think that's where the fundamental shift is. And the next kind of year and a half, I think that's going to be the fundamental shift, is making sure that these institutions understand that starting with the, you know, what a customer wants to get done first, you know, then you can kind of play back all the different features that are gonna help them achieve that goal. And what we're kind of laddering to is making a bank the place where you go and get stuff done.
Yeah.
So we link in the UK and Europe over 60 fintech products. They're all linked into our service via APIs, and all of those products are available, you know, delivered through the banking app. And we're talking about financial and non-financial products as well.
So tell me about some of those.
So for instance, we have international remittance companies, currency exchange companies. We have digital investment managers, digital mortgage brokers. The full insurance providers, the full suite really of financial services, but by leveraging the innovative fintech companies to deliver a really, really awesome solution. I think that's, you know, what's great about what we're doing and the model is that we can give the distribution to the fintech players by going through the bank. The bank gets to benefit from all of the things that fintech offers, which is the agility, the great value, the great customer experience. And the customer obviously benefits because, you know, all these great services are now kind of, you know, are now in the palm of their hand in one place. So they don't have to disintermediate, or they don't have to kind of break up all their data in different places. It's right there, and it's readily available, when they want it.
Fantastic. Well, what else can you tell us about Bud and what you got planned for the next 12 months or so?
Well, we're here in Money 2020 in Las Vegas. You probably tell by my voice that it's been a rough few days. But we're here looking for partnerships with banks over here in the US. We've had great traction in the UK and Europe. We announced last week our official partnership with HSBC to deliver open banking solution in the UK via their First Direct brand. We have a few other bank contracts, which is great in the UK and Europe. And we're looking to create a business case out here in the US. We believe very strongly in this model. We have a lot of fintech and financial services companies approaching us from the US wanting to get involved, i.e. as a vendor on the other side of the marketplace. And yeah, and we're here to talk to big banks who want to offer an amazing experience to their customers, which allows for, using multiple fintech and financial services in their banking apps. So that's why we're here, and hopefully in the next kind of few months and to a year, we'll understand the local market better. We'll start making moves on the regulation over here, and hopefully have a great announcement with a big bank in America sometime soon.
Very cool, very cool. Well, thanks for coming over to see us. And where can people catch up with the latest news and info on Bud?
Yeah, so you can tweet at us, which is @this_is_bud. Myself, you can tweet me at JC the original, or you can just head straight to our website, which is thisisbud.com.
Cool. That's pretty bold Twitter ID, JC the original.
I know, yeah.
Yeah.
I really went into it.
I like it. Yeah. Right. Thanks for joining us.
Awesome. Cheers, Brett.
Okay, so we're at Money 2020 in the podcast booth, and we're here with Lucien DeVoe from LexisNexis. So Lucien, your official title is Director Market Planning and Digital Economy, but you're in the Risk Solutions team. So tell me about what you do day to day.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I lead the strategy for the digital economy at LexisNexis Risk Solutions. And that's really comprised of fintech primarily. So a lot of online lenders and payments companies, as well as e-commerce and the sharing economy. Those also fall within my group.
Now, LexisNexis, of course, is better known in the content space and the legal industry. But where do you guys fit in the financial services space?
That's exactly right. And it's almost to the degree where we get confused from our sister company, which is the legal and professional side. We were spun off as a risk unit, and we've kind of acquired a few more data sources, so aggregated what we got from the legal side to build an entirely different business on analytics to solve things like fraud, identity management, and credit risk.
So what do you think the biggest risks facing players in the fintech and financial services space is today?
Yeah, you know, we do a lot of work to kind of understand where the market's going. And one of the recent findings was from our true cost of fraud study, which we do every year for the last 8 years. And for the first time, we were able to segment out online lending. And what we're seeing is that the cost of fraud for online lenders is actually significantly more than some of the other sectors that we've been traditionally looking at. And so that's something that I think needs to be brought to more attention and for more focus to be put on fraud in online lending.
I saw a really interesting study from TransUnion the other day showing that when you look at personal unsecured lending, that fintechs and new players have gone from 3% market share to 32% market share in just the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, the space has become very competitive, and so online lenders are trying to create as little friction as possible and enhanced customer experiences, which obviously plays against some fraud mitigation tools. And so it's really about balancing out those two things to make sure you can still deliver a delightful experience, but still having a responsible fraud program.
Yeah. So what are you doing at Money 2020, Lucien?
Yeah, one of the biggest things that Money 2020 allows us to do is to speak about sort of the breadth of our solutions. Many people only do business with us through a single portfolio of products. So whether that's credit risk and anti-money laundering or identity and fraud. And I think this just creates a wonderful platform for us to talk about all the different things and look at some cross-selling opportunities.
So if you take one specific piece of AML, the suspicious transaction reporting and so forth that we do, it seems to me to be a pretty great case study in how artificial intelligence could revolutionize the way regulators look at AML and reporting on that side. Are you guys working on solutions in that regard?
Absolutely. We're constantly looking to reduce that false positive rate, which is plaguing many organizations and really gets the cost up. And so machine learning is one of those technologies that we believe can be a real powerful tool. We also do a lot of alert remediation on behalf of our customers. So companies that just don't have the anti-money laundering and sanction screening teams can augment their workforce with some of the services that we provide as well, as we get the machine learning to catch up to where we don't need such a huge manual process.
So given that we've got a lot of listeners listening into the show, over the course of Money 2020, what do you want to say to them? How do they find out more information about you?
So I, we really think that this online lending fraud opportunity is huge. We're seeing a number of different drivers for that, whether it be sort of the empowered fraudsters that are using these faceless and remote transactions to be emboldened. And you can find out more about our survey at LexisNexisRisk.com/online lending.
Okay, LexisNexis Risk. Very cool. Yep. Now, just one last question before we leave you to it. Obviously, as we start looking at risk in these technologies, one of the interesting emerging technologies is blockchain. And we've just seen announced in Brazil that they plan to put a sort of national ID platform on the blockchain,
yep,
to reduce identity fraud or identity theft. Where do you think blockchain fits into risk over the next 10, 15 years?
I'm no, by any means, a blockchain expert, but where I really think it can be powerful is in the identity space and allowing consumers to have more control over their data in a distributed way. So I think that perhaps the powerhouses of identity management is now going to be more distributed and sort of democratized by a technology like blockchain.
Great. Lucien Duval, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you, Brett.
This is Jason Henricks filling in for Brett King on Breaking Banks, and today joined by Hank Uberoy, CEO of Earthport, one of the early leaders in the fintech revolution, founded way back in 1996, which pretty much makes Earthport a dinosaur within fintech these days. Do you feel like a dinosaur, or is there still a lot of spring in the step at Earthport?
No, there's definitely a lot of spring in the step, because the very thing that we've been championing for, I wouldn't say since 98, because we kind of reinvented the company in 2010-11. But everything we've been championing is now suddenly coming to the forefront, and it's no more a situation where we have to create the market or explain to people that a change is needed. Everybody realizes this change is needed.
So it's saving you a lot of breath that the industry realizes things might be broken and it's time to change. What was it you were evangelizing back in 2010?
Fundamentally, that cross-border payments, the way it's done today, is the wrong. It's wrong not because the technology is wrong, but the model is wrong. It is done through this method called correspondent banking, where you have hundreds of banks with connections with hundreds of other banks, and that is not the way any efficient clearing model works, where you need a hub and spokes model rather than a many-to-many model.
So, but was that a model issue, or didn't that start technologically because only those large banks had liquidity in multiple places and the ones who could actually make that happen technologically? I guess it didn't feel like technology, but they had the money across separate continents to make that happen.
Well, it was a model issue, and the model worked when there were a handful of banks in a handful of countries that were doing the majority of the payments. As the cross-border flows of funds exploded and went from tens of banks to thousands of banks to millions of companies and billions of payments, it becomes an N squared problem, where if you have N players, you need N square connections, whereas a hub and spokes model is an N plus one connection.
Yeah. So what changed in the geo landscape that suddenly that became inefficient? Can you point to a single driver or two where you say, wow, globalization arrived and that led to the need for a many-to-many type of model?
Like many things, there comes a tipping point, and it's not any one factor.
Yeah.
The fact that cross-border payments and correspondent banking is inefficient has been quite obvious for a long time to come. Some of it was lack of pressure. Some of it was vested interest in making money. Some of it was lack of solutions. And what's happened over the last, I'd say, 2 to 3 years is, firstly, certain industries, like the e-commerce industry, has exploded on a cross-border basis, and they are less tolerant of inefficient processes.
Yep.
Second has been regulation, which has started to demand transparency. It's no more okay to be able to send payments anywhere in the world and you have no idea how much will arrive. Third is de-risking of the banks, the very thing that the banks were doing, which is going further and further out around the world. Now they want to be in less places. And as they want to be in less places, their customers are becoming more global.
Yep.
And so, you know, we are actually in the perfect position where just as our model has become accepted and we have credibility with some of the largest and most sophisticated banks in the world, the market is moving towards us, given regulation, demand, and de-risking.
Well, the ultimate irony here, right, that for the longest time, it was regulation that enabled the large incumbent financial institutions to avoid innovation because it was so hard for new entrants to get in. Now is the very thing that is pushing for transparency, making them open the kimono and driving this further and further.
Absolutely. The one thing I would say is, though, it is still very hard because the regulatory framework, you know, and I think when people think of cross-border payments, the first thing that comes to mind is technology. It's the model, it's regulation. It's a highly complex regulatory framework that spans across 150 regulators. So while it's hard enough to do a regulated business in one country, the minute you go cross-border, the complexity increases by multiple orders of magnitude.
So isn't that one of the arguments that you hear in startup land today, that, you know, cryptocurrency can solve this because it rides at a level above what a single regulator can do? Do you think crypto has a place in cross-border in solving this?
So there are many niches in which there can be many solutions, and crypto can certainly play a role. Currently, it's playing a role in not such attractive niches, but it could evolve into more attractive niches. But I was in a, you know, sort of a interesting forum in D.C. Just last week, and the discussion came up, and one very senior regulator stood up and basically said, yeah, it could work when there are no more governments and there are no more regulations and governments are willing to give up the control over monetary policy and control over currency, yeah, then we might have, you know, a single monetary system in the world. But in the meantime, we're going to need regulations and somebody's going to have to navigate it. In the current model, everybody has to navigate it. With our model, we do it and others get to take advantage of it.
Yeah. So breaking away from crypto then for a second, do you see blockchain bringing further efficiencies to this?
Eventually, I think it will play a role. But again, like in anything else that it deals in a complex ecosystem, in the current world, what's wrong with it is the fact that you have thousands of banks needing to interconnect with each other, do compliance on each other, KYC on each other, refresh it every year. The problem with a blockchain applied to cross-border payments is that in order for it to work, every node has to be interconnected.
Or you need to run systems in parallel. You have the old system and the new blockchain.
Or you need in a regulated hub in the middle where you can use any technology, like in our model currently.
Yep.
You can connect into us using whatever method you want. We then deliver payments around the world using the best technology possible.
You choose the rails that it's going to go on, traditional rails, ACH.
ACH, faster payments, blockchain. And the advantage of this model is on day one, you can access any bank account in the world. You don't have to wait for some utopian future where everybody's interconnected. If they do become interconnected, then we will leverage it. If they don't, you still can make your payments on day one. So the idea really is to create a heterogeneous connector, which will use the best way possible, whether it's instantaneous payments or motorcycles.
Put those cash on the back of a moped, have people go running around.
Well, that is theoretically the case, though the one we will move money from anything to anything other than cash. Because given the regulatory framework that we play in, we are one of the unique players that offers and is used by not only all the emerging business models, but also by the traditional business models like the existing money transfer companies and banks. Our clients include 6 of the top 20 banks in the world. There's no other payments company that can make that claim.
So let's talk about the existing markets versus the new markets. That's one of the things that I personally find very interesting, because one of our biggest disadvantage in the further evolved world within financial payments is our technology is frankly good enough for a lot of things. But if you look at a lot of Africa or what India is doing, where they don't have good enough, they have the opportunity to leapfrog. What's the most exciting thing you see happening in some of these developing economies?
Oh, without a doubt, we've seen this in industry after industry. We saw it in the phone industry. Because we had an existing phone system, we never quite adopt the mobile technologies. And India basically had no phone system.
We have no landlines, therefore.
Yeah, and same thing is true with many other industries. And it'll certainly be the case with payments. You've seen it in China already, where it is leapfrogged into one of the most exciting, you know, currency-less, almost card-less payments infrastructure, which is completely on the mobile. India is basically, again, leapfrogging it. And so I think it's quite exciting. I'd say, from our standpoint, the most excitement we are seeing is the fact there's a recognition of change. We are positioned to do it. And we are doing it not as a disruptor, but as a solution provider to various elements of the ecosystem. So from the incumbents to the upstarts, we're reducing the cost of entry. People can enter this business much more easily with somebody like us in place, so you don't have to build your own rails.
Now, Earthport has one of the more interesting features in that you work across almost virtually, I think, every industry out there. It's not like you have a sub-industry or sub-vertical specialization. Are there certain verticals that you feel are pulling further ahead in the use of blockchain or innovation and their demand for it that you can see because you do have that unique view?
I'd say that a lot of the banks are experimenting with it, partly because they don't understand it. So it's, and they're the incumbents, so they want to experiment with it. In terms of seeing it adopted in a production capacity, I don't think it's anywhere yet.
Okay. So we'd love to finish with 3 rapid-fire questions I ask as part of the FinTech 5, the podcast that I hope hosts. It's one of my favorites to get insight into people. First, what do you think is the most overhyped part of FinTech today?
Blockchain.
And what is the most underrated part of FinTech?
The understanding of the complexity of operating a regulated business.
Oh, yeah, that regulated thing you just can't escape from. Finally, what is your biggest pet peeve, fintech or not?
Is the pace of adoption and evolution in the financial industry. You can have the most obvious solution in the world, but there is no way to speed up the pace at which banks move.
Yeah, that actually goes back to your most underrated directly. So thank you, Hank Oberoi, CEO of Earthport, for joining us today, and look forward to seeing great things from Earthport in the future.
Thank you.
I knew that was an awful lot, a little bit like playing on the slot machine. We're going to take a quick break, go play a couple hands of blackjack, and we'll be right back.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity. This podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. We're excited to continue the dialogue with a bunch of exciting innovators from big companies and small. Let's keep going with some of the exciting announcements happening in Vegas.
Well, JP Nichols here at Money 2020 with Andre Cherney from Aspiration. Welcome, Andre.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Aspiration.
Aspiration is a financial firm with a conscience. We bring banking, investing, retirement products to people that are not only best in class, but help them do well and do good at the same time. Try to bring to everyday people the kinds of products that will not only put money in their pocket and help them reach their own financial goals, but help them make the world a better place at the same time.
You know that's a line right out of Silicon Valley, right?
Well, a lot of people talk that. I think if you look at what we're doing, we're actually walking the walk. I'll tell you a little about it. First of all, our core product is our bank account called the Aspiration Summit account. 1% interest, 100 times higher interest than people are getting from just about any bank out there. No monthly fees, no overdraft fees, no ATM fees. And it's not only fossil fuel free, but actually has something called the Aspiration Impact Measurement. With the purchases you make through your Aspiration debit card, you can see your own personal sustainability score, something that people have never been able to see before. You see the people and the planet score of the different businesses where you're shopping, and you see the people and planet score of other businesses in that category. So what it means is for the first time, people can actually make daily spending and shopping decisions based not only on cost and quality and convenience, but on conscience as well. I'll give you another example. Our investment product is Aspiration Redwood Fund, 100% fossil fuel free, 100% firearm free, invest in companies with really great environmental, employee, diversity, governance practices, available at $100 and has literally beaten the S&P by double digits over the past couple of years.
Okay, so you're kind of bringing this whole, conscientious investing to everyday banking transactions.
Right.
So you spoke here at Money 2020 yesterday. What did you talk about?
Well, that was part of a great group of people talking about the future of banking. and really asking this question that I think a lot about is banking facing its blockbuster moment? And what that really means is you look back at Blockbuster Video Store, and sometimes you can see the outlines of those stores in places all around your neighborhood.
Right.
A big business that went away. You think about that story, 10 or so years ago, they actually could have bought Netflix for only a few million dollars.
They turned them down.
And they turned them down. The CEO said that just never going to happen. And what was the story of Blockbuster? They said people are always going to want to walk into that brick and mortar location. They're always going to walk into that Blockbuster branch and talk to the person behind the counter there. And that turned out not to be true. The other part of that story is think about where they were making their money. It wasn't on renting you that VHS tape. It was on hoping, praying that you're late to return that VHS tape or that you forget to rewind.
Well, that's right. That's the apocryphal story of the founding of Netflix, right? Reed Hastings was supposedly subject to those late fees.
Yeah.
Didn't like that result. There wasn't an alternative, so he created one. Do you have a similar kind of inspirational story for aspiration? Was there a particular moment that you had that said, I've had enough and I'm going to go create my own thing?
Probably not one single moment, but really maybe a lifetime of moments, the way we've all had. I grew up a child of recent immigrants who struggled economically, and I saw that firsthand about the kind of challenges they were facing and really not having the financial products out there that would help them have the peace of mind about making ends meet and paying rent and putting food on the table for us, and really had this passion around bringing economic opportunity to people and economic justice. And so I've worked on that for 20 plus years, whether in public policy and used to work in Washington as a financial fraud prosecutor, and then really have the sense that banking needs to change, that we need financial firms that were really aligned with the interests and values of their customers, and that people really loved and wanted to be part of and trusted. One of the things we do that's special at Aspiration and our core business model is what we call pay what is fair. Customer decides what to pay us for any of our products, any of our services. If you want to pay us zero, you pay us zero. If you think we deserve to be paid zero, then that's what we deserve to be paid, because we haven't done a good enough job for you. And what that does is not only builds up trust with people who understand that really for the first time their bank and financial service provider is going to be working for them, but also that trust that we're going to be working overtime for you. We're going to be delivering for you in such a degree, so wowing and eyeing you, that you choose to pay us even when you don't have to.
So what's been your experience with that so far? What level of the payments are you receiving?
I think if anybody doubts the basic honesty and honor and decency of the vast majority of Americans, this shows that to be the case. Vast majority of customers choose to pay, even though none of them have to, and they choose to pay a very fair amount. And so it's been very successful for us as a company, not only in being able to grow very fast because of this trust that we're building with people, but also in terms of people really feeling like they're part of this community where they each have a stake and they each have a responsibility.
So are you set up as a nonprofit?
No, not at all.
All right,
we are very much a for-profit, and we're doing great in terms of being able to build predictable revenue that's there month in and month out, and growing fast because of it.
So you're really taking a risk then with that pay what you want strategy, and you have to build some forecast and predictability into that over time. Do you have enough data yet to kind of figure
out? Absolutely. We've been doing it now for 2.5 years, and the numbers are very clear and very predictable. Early on, of course, it was a risk. I remember some of these early conversations with potential investors who, as you might imagine, it's a pretty short conversations when we told them what we were doing. But one of our first investors was Jeff Skoll, who was the founding president of eBay. And he said, no, this is going to work. And he said, every 10 years or so, there's a company that comes along that changes the entire industry based on a big bet on trust. That was the eBay story, where they got rid of the escrow system early on, and people just believed that you're going to trust somebody on the internet to send you the Beanie Baby or baseball card. He said, 10 years ago, if you told people there was big businesses based on staying in a stranger's bedroom or getting into a stranger's car, people would have laughed at you. And now, of course, we see Airbnb and the ride-sharing companies. And I think we're really doing something similar in financial services, of putting trust and power and an alignment of interests and values into the hands of everyday people.
Well, at the same time, then we have massive breaches of trust from some of the largest players in the industry. So I mean, that has to impact you as well. So how are you finding customers? What's your customer acquisition strategy?
It is very much based on social media. We've looked at the numbers, and our rate of social media sharing and engagement is literally about 100 times higher than the next highest financial firm, fintech or startup or anybody else that we've been able to test ourselves against. People are really passionate about being part of Aspiration. They'll share our Facebook posts thousands and thousands of times on average. And that really means that when people are hearing about Aspiration, it's not just from us telling people about it or from the media, but it means your college roommate or your aunt or uncle is telling you about it, and that, of course, has so much more credibility.
And you mentioned you spent quite a bit of time in Washington. Tell us maybe a little bit more about that, and most importantly, what you learned from that that inspired you to start Aspiration?
Well, I worked in Washington about 20 years ago for a few years. Was in the White House in the Clinton administration, and kept on working in public policy for a few years after that as well. And was, of course, inspired by what could be done in terms of helping people build assets, but also saw that there's only so much the government in this day and age can do, and that there was really a powerful need and role for the private sector to change how it does business and to be able to build financial firms that really do put their best interests of their customers at heart and help them be the kind of people they want to be.
Okay, so Andre, thanks. How do people find out more about Aspiration?
Aspiration.com or download our app. Hope to have them as customers and hope to hear from them.
Great. Andre Cherney, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now we're sitting down with token funder Alan Wunschy, Chief Token Officer. Sorry, I didn't say your name right, Alan. And Laura Pratt, founder. So tell us about Token Funder, and you guys we're on the pitch stage yesterday, and now you have a big announcement.
We're excited to be here. So Token Funder is a platform, and that platform is a platform for initial token offerings for companies to launch their own token offerings. What we had yesterday is that the Ontario Securities Commission has allowed us and has provided us with the exemptive relief from certain securities regulations to actually allow for an ITO. So first out of Ontario, first token out of Canada. So Laura has been working with the regulators quite extensively in the past year.
Yeah, we're really excited. So on November 1st, we'll be launching our own ITO for our platform. And
so you're going to start by launching your own ITO.
Yeah, so okay. We're using our own platform that others will be able to use in the future, and we'll be raising $10 million, a responsible amount. And our token is a security, and it will have distribution rights with it.
All right. So right now you're based in Toronto. You're focused on Canadian companies and approved by the Canadian regulators. So you'll be just focused on.
Approved to go worldwide.
You're approved to go worldwide.
We
okay.
are. We are rolling out first in Canada, okay. and then we will be rolling out in the U.S.
Okay.
We will be staying out of China.
Okay.
We have approvals to go worldwide, which is important. What is also really, I think, something that we believe in deeply is allowing for investors at a retail level to get in on these kind of investments. And the reason why we wanted retail is that the entire blockchain democratizes investment, and we wanted to provide that. Now, as an added feature, we've been working, and Laura can explain the details around this, but the added feature is that there's KYC and AML, which gives investor protections.
So. Yeah. So we also have some questions to see that if you know about cryptocurrencies, this is a little bit of a suitability testing, and there will be limits according to your income levels.
So I presume it's those sorts of protections that you've put in place that allowed the regulators to get comfortable with the process. I mean, what?
Yeah, we worked with the regulators over the last year and really.
Well, as part of the normal kind of investment process that any healthy capital markets really has is that anybody that's taking money from investors needs to understand who they are.
Right.
And so our regulators had looked at this entire space and had asked us to work out a model that would provide these safeguards and allowed us to innovate with this new technology. So it's really an and story for us.
You expect to see a lot of American companies taking advantage of this?
Oh, we could. Yeah, we could. Absolutely.
So what were some of the key things that the regulators were focused on?
Other than KYC and AML, some suitability questions, really the limits so that the investors are not spending more than 10% of their net worth. So online, we have a limit of $2,500 Canadian that you can invest. You can invest it through Ether, or we are actually taking fiat as well. And if you wish to go above that, we will do that offline.
Okay, so it's possible to go over. You'll just have to have additional due diligence.
Yeah, a little bit more. Okay. Yes. Yeah, but we couldn't do that online.
So, is there still a ceiling though? Is it you know, based on your net worth, or
it's based on your net worth? If you're a high net worth individual and you want to take $10 million raise. It's not something we want to do. We wanted to democratize this and put it out to the masses because there is a distribution. We would like more people to be able to get in on this.
I just add that this is a process of being in the sandbox. So the OSC, the Ontario Securities Commission Launchpad, has kind of this sandbox approach that they're inviting all the fintechs in Ontario and Canada to speak to them and to determine, you know, is their token a utility or a security that needs to be regulated? We went through that process. And so now what we have is the support to do this in an investor-friendly and investor-safeguarded mechanism. So, you know, if you had the choice of investing in an unregulated ICO that's in another jurisdiction or ours that's regulated and has safeguards, which would you choose? We hope that you choose ours and support our platform going forward.
Well, the ICO space is still early and nascent. It's the Wild West for many, and it looks like, at least for now, there's a new sheriff in town in Toronto. So Laura Pratt and Alan Wunsch, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
So we're here in the Money 2020 booth at the event floor. I've got David Schroffer. He's the CEO of Anchor ID, Future Proof Authentication.
That's exactly right.
So, David, good to see you again. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Good to see you again, Brett.
Now, you know, in terms of the ID and protecting our IDs, obviously what's top of mind at the moment is the Experian element. So
yes.
Here's a proposition I want to put to you to start off our discussion today.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that the identity data we used to think of as ways to identify a customer, date of birth, your address, your mother's maiden name, that sort of data information, social security number,
right,
is simply no longer securable because of the way, you know, the increase in cyber threats?
Yes.
And we have to think about ID in a different way.
Yes, exactly. I mean, what you're describing is personally identifiable information. Your first name, last name, address is going to be unique to you as mine is unique to me, which is why we don't use it, right? We're finding a proxy through a set of cryptographic keys on your phone. We're finding a proxy through a voice biometric that you can give us, again, through your phone, face biometrics, so a whole host of different factors of authentication.
Would it work today now that I've got a croaky voice?
Say again?
Would my voice biometric work today, given I've got a croaky voice?
Well, that's the thing. There are lots of different vendors out there making voice biometric products. And we've been using it for some time. I've had those days where I've had a croaky voice. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. The thing about biometrics is it's an authentication factor that you leave everywhere and you can't change. That can be a problem. I mean, a sophisticated enough hacker could take that coffee cup out of your hand and use it to get into your iPhone. Now, that's a bad thing. Now, that's very, very hard to do, and you've got to be sophisticated in both knowledge and equipment to make something like that happen. But the fact is, the biometric companies out there are always trying to stay one pace ahead of that, and our model is just making a reseller program effectively through our platform. So our clients can just pick the best and most accurate products that are available and not have to spend $200,000 integrating something and hope it works on the back end. Right.
So David, tell me a bit more about Anchor ID. I mean, obviously you've described the premise, but
sure.
Tell me about the business.
Well, think about it this way. Let's say you're a traditional banking customer and you've got a password for your online banking and you've got a password for your brokerage account that's different. And maybe you have an RSA token. Maybe you signed a document with pen and paper when you walked in to a branch. Maybe you get a phone call from the bank because they have detected some level of fraud or they suspect some fraud. They want to ask you security questions to make sure they called the right person. Those are all different roles. So after the bank has done a marketing profile to find out who you are, they've spent marketing dollars to try to get you to be a customer at their bank, they do all that, and then they completely fragment their relationship with you with all those different things I described. So now imagine just having every authentication attempt between you and the bank, whether you're trying to log into something or the bank's trying to contact you, everything's through the mobile device, as it should be. So if it's a lower level security function that you're trying to do, maybe a read-only version of your checking account, fine, that can be served up to your phone as a yes-no button. Now, your phone can be in sleep mode, and you'll just see a red button and a green button appear on your phone. Do you want to do this or do you not want to do this? If it's something more secure, hey, I want to transfer £100,000, okay, maybe that's just going to require biometrics of some kind, voice biometrics, face biometrics, etc. And we're using cryptographic keys underneath all of that. We can do geolocation underneath all that to make sure you don't pass the test somehow. But now you're in Bangladesh and you really should be in central London because that's where you've been every other time you've done this transaction.
Well, we did that with Moovin for account opening. And we reduced our, just by checking the geolock of the phone.
Yep.
And comparing against the physical address they were giving us as their residence.
Yes.
And, if it was literally, 1,000 miles away, then that was the red flag.
It sends up a red flag, and then you can react to that from there. Yeah. We're looking past the point that passwords simply go away. We think it's going to happen. We think every new service that makes a customer create another password, or like I said, the banking relationship that just has a multitude of passwords and PIN numbers and signatures, etc. If you can channel that all through the phone, you've got a great record of exactly what that authentication was, what product worked, where was that person at the time of that, and you've got an awfully good-looking profile. KYC compliant, by the way.
You say, I've got a good-looking profile? I appreciate
you,
that.
You always have, Brett, but I'm actually talking about digital science. Right?
So, I'm signature adverse, as you know, from my digital landscape. And my premise is that if banks want to compete with fintechs and others, they're going to have to be able to deliver business in real time without a wet signature.
Yes.
Is that a realistic proposition?
100%. So part of our product is the ability to open a DDA account or open a line of credit through the mobile device. And we ask the customer for name, address, and birthday. And that's it. So we combine that information with information that the phone itself tells us about what that device is. We send all that to the mobile carrier, and the carrier will say, okay, he got the right name, he got the right address, he got the right birthday. So now we've got a record, and here's some more information about the phone. The account is in a good status, there's not been any charge off here, it hasn't been jailbroken. All right, this customer looks like they're pretty good. And if we want to go all the way to a credit decision, we can then take that whole set of packaged information. Again, the user gave us 3 data points. The rest came from machine-to-machine dialogues. We can then take that to a credit bureau, come back with a full credit report, which we don't keep, by the way. Again, no personally identifiable information stays in our platform. We give it to the bank. The bank can use it to make an automated decision or a manual decision.
But you tokenize it in any case, right?
Oh, tokenization is table stakes. Because this is a lot of information moving back and forth between devices and platforms, et cetera. And we take that very, very seriously. So, yeah, we use public-private key technology. We're actually going to try to implement, something called Signal, which is, you probably know, is a messaging app. The messaging app uses the same open source protocol that's been completely beat up for a long time by the security community and found to be very, very good. So basically, we're protecting the communication between the phone and the platform. Once you do that, you have a lot more latitude with things like voice samples and personally identifiable information flowing back and forth.
So we had Lending Club on the show a while back. Very interesting data point came out of that. So they said that in terms of assessing credit risk, or the risk of default specifically.
Yes.
That whether someone paid their phone bill on time,
yes,
was a far, far better predictor of default risk, right, than a credit score in the U.S.
I completely agree. But I think what's the underlying point there is that every financial institution gets to decide for themselves. If we have a banking customer or a credit union customer that just likes following the traditional rails, I want to see an Experian report before I make a decision, fine, we serve that up. If they want to see a lot of detail from the carrier, AT&T, Verizon, whoever, we can serve that up. So we let a financial institution make the decision the way that they want to make it, as opposed to trying to fit a square peg into a round hole in terms of decision making.
So right now you've got partnerships with all of the U.S. carriers?
We can get U.S. carrier data from everybody but U.S. cellular, but we're working on that.
And
that includes, by the way, the MVNOs, you know, the Boosts, right, of the world. Yeah, that's important.
And are you guys planning on going outside of the U.S. with this?
Very, very much, yeah. We want to get the U.S. market really up and running, and we're well on our way to doing that. But yeah, we want to look outside, probably the EU first, starting with the UK, and possibly Central and Latin America. Their banking systems are evolving.
Sure.
And I think they're a lot more receptive to what we would consider non-traditional, you know, for markets like the UK and the US.
Your value prop to banks, I think, is, and FIs, is pretty clear.
Yeah.
So my question is, what's your value prop to the cell networks, the network operators?
A value proposition to who?
To the network operators.
To the network operators. We're a customer. They have a set of data, and quite frankly, they make it available for a price. And if that price threshold is below what our customers are willing to pay, you know, when they need it, then we're just another customer to them in that regard. Yeah.
Now, obviously, there's some debate right now over whether this data should be owned by a provider or owned by the customer itself.
Yes.
You know, we have that in respect to aggregation services in the U.S. right now. The UK is treating this very differently. They're going towards open banking.
Yeah.
And they're forcing banks to expose that data. But when we start talking about that in the U.S., which way do you think we're going to go?
We want to provide our customers with what they want to use. I would be thrilled if every financial institution starts making their credit decision on what we would consider non-traditional data, the new stuff, the way they use the phone, the way their social profile comes back. Do they use profanity in their Facebook posts? Things like that actually matter in terms of whether or not you want to lend money to a person, or it may matter to some financial institutions. And we would be first in line to support any of those other data sources, because again, we just want to be a company that serves up to our clients what they need to make the decision they want to make.
Great. Well, David, thanks for joining us on the show today, and good luck with Money 2020 generally. You're doing some business here, you think?
Absolutely, yes.
Fantastic.
So thanks for having us. Well,
hopefully this will help.
Thank you.
No worries.
Thank you.
Well, now I'm here with Valentin Stolf and Nicholas Kopp from N26. So welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you very much for having us today.
Valentin, for those maybe not familiar, tell us about N26.
So when we founded N26 a couple of years back, we found out that most people are not satisfied with their digital banking experience. And what we did, we founded a retail bank from scratch. So today we have our own banking license in Europe. And we founded a bank that is as easy to use as using Spotify or, you know, Google Maps. And that's what we did, a fully digital bank.
So you're based in Berlin, and Nicholas, now you're looking after the U.S. business.
That's correct. We recently opened a New York office for N26, we'll have a local team working on the entry into the U.S. market.
So just looking at your address here, are you at Rise?
Correct. Yeah, on 23rd Street in Manhattan.
I'm starting to recognize that address by now, so that's good. So have you launched in the U.S. already?
We have not yet. Okay. We have announced yesterday, actually, at the Money 2020 here in Las Vegas, that we'll launch our product mid-2018.
Okay, so tell us about that announcement. Is there more to it than that? Is there new features or new kinds of things that are going to come to the U.S.?
Maybe two things to add also for the people listening. We have been in Europe, and we started out in Germany, and our company originally is headquartered in Berlin.
Right.
And then beginning of this year, we actually expanded into 17 countries in Europe. So we're live in 17 countries. We'll be coming in the UK in the first quarter next year, second quarter, I think. And now the big step out of the Eurozone and out of the European area is the first one is the US. And I think the adoption of the product, maybe you can, Nick, you can say a little bit about what we have found out about the US market and how we'll adapt the product.
Yeah, sure. So our product here in the US will be largely similar to what we have in Europe with one of the key distinctions, one or two. One of them will be looking to add an attractive rewards program. So what we found out through like just talking to people, actually, user research, interviews with potential customers, that people really like their rewards and points here in the US. So we'll add a program really geared towards millennials. So not your, you know, boring rental car, I don't know, or some sort of Hilton hotels. So we'll try and come up with a very good rewards program that caters to millennials' needs around maybe partnerships with Airbnb or Uber or Spotify, just like the products that actually millennials use these days.
So what do you think is different about the US market from some of the European markets where you're operating currently? Yeah.
So what we found out that the basic needs of the younger generation, the digital generation, are very much the same across the globe. I think the biggest differences are in the US. First, you earn more interchange, so therefore you need to invest of that into kind of the rewards program that Nick mentioned. And the second thing is people here are more using their credit cards for short-term credit lines. And in Europe, it's more a credit line that you get on your current account. So that's the biggest difference in, I would say, the day-to-day usage. The second big difference to Germany especially is in Germany, cash is still big. In the US, I mean, I haven't used a dollar since I arrived in the US, I think two weeks ago. So I have done everything via cashless. I mean, I had to use a little bit of cash for the casino here. They don't accept the card. But the rest is everything cashless. And I think that's the biggest difference.
But for some reason, we still write paper checks here, more in the US than any other country.
Yeah, I'm the wrong person to ask about this because I haven't used a check in my whole life. So it's for me, it's a little bit ridiculous that it's still used. Yes, but it's true. In the US still, a lot of the, I think, electricity companies and these guys also sometimes pay out stuff over a check that is sent. So that's a function. But mainly for us, it's not you write your own checks. It's more about cashing in checks. So I think there are a couple of digital solutions that are good for this as well.
And I think maybe adding on to that, check is obviously important here. But at the end of the day, I think the needs, to Valentin's points, across our user groups, they're really the same. So I think no one really likes to use checks, actually. So I think over time, we might offer some functionality in the beginning, but I think over time, we hope that we migrate also to a checklist product.
So while the markets are different and the structure and the regulatory schemes are different, you're actually seeing a lot in common with the customers. The customers' needs and the customers' pain points are pretty similar in country after country.
So I think what we are catering or what we tailored our product to is really a very slick experience, saving users time, a lot of transparency, and especially in the last year, we've been expanding into all the products around the current account. So we have done credit lines, we have done saving products, investment products, we've integrated in Europe an insurance wallet. So it's really the one place for your financials with one click and always a very, very sleek user experience. And I think the needs are pretty much the same, and people want to save time. They don't want to waste time on searching the internet for the best products. They want to have a trusted party that suggests maybe a couple of products that they can use with a very, very simple user experience. And that's what we do in the US as well, because we have found out that most of the banks here are even like using older technology than the ones in Europe. And we see a big niche in terms of how fast we can innovate and how quick we can be. And I think a lot of US customers also ask us to bring the product here on our waiting list already. And I think that's just something that we do know.
Well, that's great. You've certainly gotten a lot of great press in Europe and excited to look for the launch in the U.S. in mid-2018. So Valentin Stolf and Nicholas Kopp from N26, thanks for being on Breaking Banks.
Yeah, thanks for having us here.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for this week's show. We'll be back next week with more. Remember, you can find Breaking Banks and all of the great Provoke.fm shows on SoundCloud and Stitcher, on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play. If you like the show, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. It really helps other people find the show. Learn more at BreakingBanks.com and Provoke.fm.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.